is it has apparently limited the amount of money that attorneys are getting out of it, and probably is going to limit the amount of money that is going to be paid for non-economic damages. In other words, there's a corridor that isn't going to be violated.
If I could, one last question on that before I go on. Do you see any reason, let's focus on structured settlement for a moment. Do you see any reason why a structured settlement requirement would tend to increase or decrease the number of cases going to trial?
No, I don't think it would.
I don't think that has any effect on it. I think that a structured settlement guarantees the person that they're going to be taken care of, good or bad. That's what it does.
And if I can, thank you very much. I have a question for Mr. Hunter. By the way, there are a lot of questions on insurance, assertions about the insurance industry that are right or wrong that I'd love to either challenge you with my own statistics or discuss. But my focus today is just on tort reform and not on the behavior of the insurance industry. So I just have one question for you that I'd like to ask. Do you favor or oppose going to a system of straight several liability?
I don't know yet. We don't have the data. I think that can be studied. The closed planning surveys can disclose exactly how that impacts. You don't know what it would do in terms of cutting costs to go to. I tell you one thing. I've heard cases that argue me both ways. I've heard cases where in New York City, for example, a little bit of dirt filled up, a guy was drunk, jumped the median and killed somebody, and they got the city of 1% liable because it was a ramping effect of the dirt and they should have cleaned it, and I thought that was nonsense. And they paid, and because of joint and several, they had to pay quite a bit of money in New York. But I've heard of other cases where, for example, a child was driving a bike down a road, some employee had left the manhole cover off, and the boy, because it was dusk coming home from school, had to swerve to avoid it and ran in front of a car and got hit, and the car should have stopped. And the city was held 25% liable because the car really should have had to stop. But the insured only had basic limits. There was hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical bills alone. And for me, I would oppose in that kind of a case saying to the child, you've got to eat it because we're going to protect the city, who was 25% liable, and the accident never would have happened if they didn't leave the manhole cover off. I would worry about the child and his family. Why should we wipe out that child and family for some kind of theoretical nice percentage? It doesn't make sense to me, particularly when you could hypothesize that the insurance company for both the driver and the city might be Aetna. I don't see any point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I really got to run, but thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to the work session on Friday.
Thank you, Representative Regan. Representative Miller?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you and I planned, we cut it down just the two of us. We'll decide this whole matter. We'll let you know what our decision is tomorrow morning. I've been listening a lot, trying to determine in what areas there's some commonality and agreement. And I just want to kind of throw out a hypothesis. Suppose we took the several suggestions that were made by Mr. Hunter. And I'm leaving out some of them that I'm sure there isn't common agreement on, Mike, reinsurance. He makes a strong case for it, but I think there's probably people on the other side that don't agree with that at all. But suppose we did, for instance, put an actuary in the division, put a consumer advocate someplace outside of the division, but on the target. Suppose we did, as he suggested, limit plaintiff and defense fees and impose sanctions for the frivolous suits and contrary motions that are the other half of that. Suppose we said that there are no secret agreements. We did somehow or other mandate a lot more arbitration, either compulsory or volunteer, and improve the system by allowing for service by mail and other things like that. None of which seems to me too contradictory from everything I've heard all of you saying. If we did all that, I just kind of ask maybe both sides to comment, what would happen? Would we simply just have a better system for the people who are injured, which may be a goal enough, or would there be, you know, a shade more insurance available where there perhaps is not right now, or would there be a shade more or shade less cost to the consumer? That's just kind of a field of that question. I'd just be interested in getting your reaction.
Reaction to the group to that. I think that putting an actuary in the commissioner's office would be a big waste of money, because I don't think he could keep busy doing actuary work and using his talents and his skills in the office as he should. He wouldn't. You'd be spending a lot of money for doing some other work other than actuary work, because there isn't that much necessary judgment to be exercised on rates.
Excuse me, let me correct myself on that. I was thinking in terms of actuary being the way we do it in our retirement system. We contract, the state of Alaska contracts with an actuary who's our official actuary for the state, and he does work on
I'm sure you do that now. I'm sure that your commissioner's office uses actuaries whenever they need it and pay them a fee for it, and that's a proper and reasonable way to do it. The business of coming at this as if the whole problem results because you've got an unregulated industry, I think, just is ridiculous. The insurance industry is probably the most heavily reporting and heavily regulated set of financial activities that you can find. And I don't know what other information that there is that we could give to you as an insurance officer, as a state which has some responsibility for its citizens, than what we already give. It's tons and tons of it. You know every investment we make. The one thing you don't know is how much reserves we put up on individual cases, but you do know them in totality. And your commissioner tells us when he thinks, and he's told us that he thinks our rates ought to go up. He told us last year. We think he's right. I don't know what else you could do to further regulate the insurance industry, if that's the thrust of what your question was. I think it was.
Well, the thrust was, what if we did the things I enumerated? Would that have any effect? And I guess you're saying...
This one would not. The things I addressed would not.
Senator, I'll take a crack at that. I think the insurance department could probably use some help. I don't know whether it's actuarial help that's needed. I'm sure I don't know for a fact, but I presume that they can hire people on a contract basis. I think what's more important, however, in the environment that we operate in, and we are in a competitive environment despite the fact there's a rate law that gives the commissioner, the director, the authority to regulate our rates, is some kind of a better solvency analysis ability. So maybe that's not an actuary, that's a financial analyst or something like that, and someone who can help the director decide what's really going on in the marketplace. That's particularly important in a state like Alaska, which is really a very small market. My company writes something like 7 or 8% or something of the general liability stuff here, and that's only $2.5 million worth of premium a year. It's a small amount of money in the overall scheme of things. So the balances in this market are much more delicate than they are in a place like California, where you have hundreds of companies really going at one another. So I think maybe the department could maybe use some help, but I'd hesitate to say it has to be actuarial. I'm not real enthusiastic about the consumer advocate, just because I think it makes things more polemic. Mr. Hunter used a couple of examples. One of them was New Jersey. It should come as no surprise to you that the insurance industry's view of New Jersey is it is absolutely the worst market you can do business in. Things are just at loggerheads there all the time. And that's not to blame the consumer advocate. The consumer advocate is doing what the consumer advocate is supposed to be doing. But what you then do is raise the heat in the debate without a lot of light. The reforms that Mr. Hunter talked about as structural reforms, I think fee limitation. I tell you what I think we have to get at ultimately, and it's a decision of whether we want to reduce expectations. That's what this whole system operates on, our expectations. If lawyers, including defense lawyers, begin to expect less, perhaps that gets into the populace generally, and they talk to their clients about, instead of let's go out there and get every nickel we can get, they have to say, well, wait a minute, we have to be reasonable about this. Now, we want to get you compensated, but you have to understand there are limits. Something like that will take probably beyond our lifetimes to see the effect of something like that. This has built up over years and years. We have an evolutionary system that we are not, by one single legislative act, you are not going to stop that evolution. So I think that would probably have a salutary effect. And the frivolous lawsuit thing, I don't see how anybody could disagree with that. How you do it, who decides what's frivolous, is a very difficult thing. I'm sort of getting into the judge's area now, and I've never been a judge, but gee, that's... Our system says if you have a claim, you present it. And contingent fees allow. It's the poor man's key to the courthouse. Maybe the lawsuit that was filed a few years ago in California alleging that the skateboard was defective because it didn't have brakes, maybe that's a frivolous lawsuit. I would think, that's what I thought when I read about it in the newspaper. But there are a lot of, the big gray area, so I don't know. Giving judges the authority to do something probably is a good idea, and then telling them to use it is something. You just heard the judge say we're a little reluctant to tinker with what the jury has told us. The no secret agreement stuff, I don't see any problem with that at all. I think that's a good idea. I don't know whether it has any long-term or short-term effect on, and I really don't know. I'd be guessing on that. And the arbitration, I think that goes to the expectation question, not to the cost question. Arbitration costs money, too. It's quicker. It's less aggravated. The plaintiff doesn't have to have a kind of continuing psychic injury just because he or she has to maintain the ability to recover, but it costs money to arbitrate. You have to pay arbitrators, and you have to use up some kind of time. I don't know whether there's a lot of cost savings, but I do think it's better to get to use alternative dispute resolution mechanisms to get across the word to the public that this is not a totally free, without responsibility society. We have to learn how to sit down and talk about our problems and get them resolved in a better way. I don't know if you had other ones. Those are the only ones I checked as you went through.
I'd just like to say quickly, we have mandatory arbitration for claims under $15,000, but there is a right to a trial de novo, and that's because our Constitution guarantees jury trial.
Do most people end up using it?
If it's under $15,000, the judge has the right to order it. Now, that does have some salutary effects, and the RAND study that was mentioned here earlier has indicated that there are very few people that are willing to appeal that decision.
Did you say 1-5 or 5-0?
15,000.
15,000.
Yeah. It does resolve a lot of disputes. It helps, but it only applies in the small ones, the under 15,000. With regard to the attorney's fees, that probably has some salutary effect, and I wouldn't discount that. But and the purpose for the reduction in attorney's fees is to guarantee the plaintiff gets more of the settlement, that he ends up with more money in his pocket. That's the purpose of the fee schedule, to make sure the attorney gets enough to guarantee his interest in the case and to file it and to carry through with it. And medical malpractice cases are tough to prosecute because they're a lot of work. And that's why we want something in there in the early stages. The earliest stage is higher than the normal fee awarded in medical malpractice for a contingent fee, but the later stages are smaller. So it would help some in the larger cases, but I don't think that would be a big item as far as reducing or ameliorating the problems with the tort system. As far as regulating the insurance industry, if you feel that it's necessary to have extra help, I'd say do it. I have no quarrel with what you want to do in that regard. My personal experience in the legislature is that the legislators are the best watchdog of the public interest rather than a hired consumer advocate. You have the non-paid consumer advocates that do an excellent job, I've never been a firm advocate myself of hiring the ombudsman to raise hell on state payroll.
Could I come in with one caution, that if in your legislation you are going to introduce cap figures like $250,000 or figures below which claims must go to arbitration, that you build into the legislation a formula so that those figures increase progressively year by year following inflation, so that you don't have to pass subsequent new amending legislation, keep putting it right. This helps the insurance industry enormously if they can know from year to year what the figure is likely to be when the time comes to settle.
May I make one last comment concerning your question? I think that basically what has caused this difficulty is a development over the last 25 to 30 years of a new industry in the United States, which you can call the liability industry. It has been sedulously cultivated, it has been carefully nurtured. There's been almost nobody with a rein on it to hold it back. It has gone wherever it wants to go in the courts in the various parts of our nation, in some states worse than in others. And for the first time now, the public is becoming aware of what this is beginning to cost, and it is a tremendous cost. It pervades absolutely every human activity that we engage in. And I think it is time that all legislatures began to take another look at this, because if you don't, it is entirely in the hands of only one group of people, and that is the attorneys and the insurance companies. Insurance companies are complaining right now because they've been losing their shirts for the last two to four years. So now it's only the attorneys who are making any money, and they're the only ones who are here saying to you, don't change anything. We like it just the way it is. And the reason they do is because they've built it carefully, piece by piece, year after year, for the last 30 years, and nobody's looked at them, nobody's stopped them, nobody's argued with them, and you can't get it through our legislature because you've got plaintiff's lawyers all over the place that won't let you touch a thing. Now, you have an opportunity here. I think you have to send a signal around the country, perhaps, that maybe things are going to change here, and there are some things that you ought to be doing. We don't know what they are. We don't even know whether these things are going to work. We don't know whether they're working in California. But somebody's got to look at it and start thinking about it and give some expression to what the public is stirring about. They're saying, stop this. We don't want to pay this much money anymore for all of these things. And there's an awful lot of chicanery that's entered into this, and nobody's watching these guys anymore. Somebody, please, legislature, watch this thing for us. Stop it. Hold it up. Just slow it down a little bit. Try a few things. Because nobody else has tried anything for years and years and years. It's all been going the other way.
Okay,
I'd like to comment on the list. First of all, I think the list is terrific.
Who is its author?
You don't want to take a little plagiarism.
But it won't do everything. I think the actuary division or beefing up the division in appropriate ways and the consumer advocate add a element of believability in the public's eye, at least, that something is being done to protect them at a time when rates are going up 400%, 1,000%, cancellations of coverage overnight, and those kinds of things. Some states have moved to require that insurers give 60 days notice of cancellation, non-renewal, or significant price increases. It turns out those states have consumer advocates' offices. They were the ones who moved first because the consumers put some pressure on, they called it raising the heat without light, but they raised the heat, yeah. They raised the heat in New Jersey and South Carolina, and they got those. Those were the first two states that had consumer advocate offices. But Maine has now moved, Oklahoma, Florida, Massachusetts. And it's clear that Arkansas has moved. It's clear that that other states are beginning to move in that direction. The consumer advocate is a tremendous idea, and it can be funded off budget. And it's clear that rather than having apologistic statements trying to defend the insurance industry, you might have somebody come in with some statements that would be appropriately condemning. The insurance industry hasn't studied its regulatory regime by the General Accounting Office in 1979, and it was found to be hopelessly inadequately staffed. The regulatory regime in a report called Issues and Needed Improvements in State Regulation of Insurance by the General Accounting Office, and it was found to be lacking arm's length relationship with the industry it regulates. And I don't think it's different here. The other study is Harvard University in something called the Regulatory Executives. It found that the insurance regulators of the country view their role as judge. Two out of three insurance regulators view their role as that of judge. Only one out of three, by their own words, view their role as an advocate for the public or something different than a judge. Well, that's fine if you have both sides before you. But when you have one side before you, two out of three is terrible from the consumer viewpoint. So I would encourage you to move on these things for the purpose of making the people of the state feel more comfortable that if rates are up 400%, maybe they really should be up 400%, rather than this vague feeling that something more devious is going on. These other limits, the sanctions, the fees, and so on, I think would have salutary effects. I don't think that it would have solved the availability problem. I have called for the additional item of reinsurance. I think reinsurance, if the state could move in there, would make insurance available, and in fact would reduce costs, because self-insured groups could then form and be reinsured by the state. So you could have the nurse midwives coming together and self-insuring, or other groups, fishermen. People who own aircraft and like who had to meet standards for the group, and then could, to meet the reinsurance standards. We didn't insure everybody in riot reinsurance. We wouldn't have made money doing that. We insured those who met the standards. But we told them what the standards were. We inspected them. If they met the standards, they were reinsured. And besides, I don't think Alaska moving alone can control the cycle. That's a national problem. Texas tried to put a floor in when they saw the rates going down too fast and did hold the rates up, but couldn't control the effects of the cycle. It's a national, international problem, as witness of Ontario. Reining in the tort law, taking away victims' rights. We don't know if they'll work, quote unquote, this gentleman said, but do it anyway. That's absurd. You can find out if they'll work. You can, in fact, get the data. I could show you a 21-volume study of the Department of Transportation that led us to agree that no fort was the right thing to do. I could show you studies, more recent studies, on closed claim from Rand Institute. Got them right when he can tell you exactly how the various states compare on a closed claim basis, how victims fare versus their damages, how lawyers make out, and so on. These things are doable. They're in the insurance company file. The only question you have to ask yourself is, the insurance companies come to you and say, please change the tort law. Please do something. Please rein it in. And yet, they don't come forward with the data that's in their own files to show how their insureds and the victims that they compensate are faring under the current system. They don't come forward and to show you how the new system they propose would work. Would it reduce costs? Would it reduce time? What kind of victims would be left over? These things are calculable, at least to a certain extent. There may be, obviously, there's got to be some judgment, but based on historic patterns of payouts, you can tell what would have happened if I did this to this particular victim. And those things should be done. The question I ask is, since they have the data in their files, have they done the study? If not, they're naive. Why do they come to the legislature and say, we don't know if it will work, when they have the data in their files to at least make a first stab at it? The other question has to be, if they have done the studies, where are they? Why don't they publish it?
Thank you. I think that I apologize for the lateness of the hour. I still have a couple more questions, if you don't mind. Mr. Hunter, I guess I should correct you that, although I'm sure you won't agree with this statement, it wasn't the insurance companies who proposed the tort reforms in the legislature. It was a legislator, and they're pushed by the tort reform people, and there may be some tie to what insurance companies would like to see. However,
there's no question that around the nation the insurance companies are actively supporting all the tort reform efforts, and I'm sure you'll find them here, too.
Thank you. Also, I'd like to ask a question to Mr. Schuber and also Mr. Connelly, and even Mr. Charlesworth. Yesterday, we had testimony to the fact that no matter what we do, even if we pass wholesale tort reform, everything that is in House Bill 532, which has, I think, all 16 points. Even if we do that, the insurance crisis itself will probably be over within 18 months, and that the effects of the reforms, as they're termed, there won't be any noticeable effect for some period of time after that. And you stated, Mr. Schubert, that we don't know if they'll work, okay? And certainly they're not going to have any effect. Would you, as a judgment call, would you say that it would be responsible by a legislature to try and attempt to pass, and I'm speaking primarily for myself, this is my first time, I wasn't here in 75, I've become kind of a pseudo-expert in the last 6 months on insurance, and I've learned a wealth in the last couple of days. So what I'm wondering, would it be responsible for me to pass something that I wasn't sure would work, and you're not even sure will work, and just pass it and hope for the best? And what about the problems that will create by that type of an approach?
I don't know of anyone who can tell you that any course that any human being takes or any group of human beings takes is going to work. There's always unintended consequences of everything that happens. And for
that's what I'm getting at.
Right. But for me to tell you that I could assure you, and I would love to be able to do it, if you pass this, we're going to be able to reduce rates 10, 15, 20% down the line. But honestly, we can't. We can't because we don't know what the effects are going to be. This is as much a mystery to the insurance people, and it's a mystery on which their money is put, and the people to whom they sell insurance, their money is put on it too. It's as much of a mystery to them as it is to anyone.
Would you advocate in that respect, then, a cautious approach to tort reform? And I'm not talking about the studies, I guess, were done in 75, 76, whenever the last crisis hit. There's data, I guess, to try and show what possible effect tort reform will have, but there's no certainty. So would you say that we should pass them? We have a 120-day session, of which we have about 80 days left?
Yes.
80 days left in order to try, less than 80, I guess, in order to try to push this legislation through. And the problem that I'm getting, and as I get deeper into it, the more I feel this way, is that we haven't studied it enough. And we've had testimony that says, don't study it to death. It's been studied, don't study it to death. Well, I'm a public policy maker for this state. I'm new. I haven't studied it to death. And that may be one of the problems with trying to get this passed over and over again.
I think there are certain suggested reforms in here which are clearly, logically, very likely to reduce some costs. And just go for those if you can't go. But do some token thing, at least, not token, but something that you really think bears a logical likelihood that it's going to have an effect of reduction in costs. One of them, obviously, is Rule 82. That's just an awful thing, and it's unique here. Another one is put some limits on the amounts of money that people are talking about in their settlement conferences. One of those is a pain and suffering opportunity for the plaintiff, and the second one is the opportunity that the plaintiff's attorneys love and dearly protect, and that is a contingency fee. We don't want you to abolish it. What we want you to say is we're not going to pay great one. We're not going to let you charge 50% of a jumbo verdict because that is more than your services are worth. I cited yesterday a case of a little girl who was paying her lawyer something in the neighborhood of $1,000 a day or $2,000 a day for 18 months of her life. That's ridiculous. It is not fair. And even if it's customary in the judicial system, it still isn't fair. And it's still a waste of money. These are obvious things that can be addressed. And there are several other things in that list of suggestions or list of contents of this bill that could also be chosen from if you don't want to pass the whole thing in a bucket.
Can I say this? If you liken the legislation you're proposing to driving a car and seeing an obstacle ahead of you, you've got to put the brake on. You can't be sure that you're going to be able to stop in time before you hit that obstacle. By God, you still put the brake on just the same. Now, the gentlemen from the insurance industry here are being painfully honest with you. They're not going to make claims that your legislation will rapidly reduce premiums. It won't, but it will in fact have a steadying effect on the atmosphere of the awards that have been coming out of Alaska. This will encourage some insurers who, while being licensed in Alaska, will now start selling business in Alaska, bring a bit of competition in, and this should begin to make the rate of growth of premium certainly reach a figure, or come down to a figure that can be swallowed by the general populace and bears a closer relationship to ordinary inflation. We all have to accept that with inflation, awards go up, and premiums go up with it. But the unstable atmosphere here has got to be tackled, and you need to be bold about it by carrying out the measures that Mr. Schuber here has encouraged.
I might say, as a former legislator, you never expect to solve all the problems in one session. If you put everything into one bill and expect to solve the problems, it's just never done.
Or expect it to pass.
Or expect it to pass, and I've had that experience too. But what you do is you go at a piecemeal. You do the best you can. You try to hit the things that you think are going to be effective, that you have some certainty of approaching a solution to the problem, and see how those work. Now, if you're going to ruin the situation, if you're going to wipe out the tort system, I'd say don't do that. But you should make an honest approach to try to hit at what the real problem is and do something about it and take a leadership role in that regard.
That is exactly my intention, but I just wanted to make sure that I got on the record that the changes are not going to have an immediate effect. See, we're being pushed now, and we're getting personal opinion messages from everybody who's had their insurance increased or canceled who's saying, we want tort reform because they've been told that it's going to allow them to get insurance. Maybe not by the insurance companies, by someone. Okay. Now, whether or not that'll have an effect, we don't know. But that's what they believe. And the perception out there is that if we pass tort reform, we're going to get insurance and we're going to get...
It's taken us 10 years to get the courts to agree that what we passed in 75 is even enforceable. So if you pass something, I expect to see your thing litigated, whatever it is, and probably take you 5 years. It takes us longer in California, but I would guess it'll take you 5 years before you even know whether it's a good law.
You know, if you want to put the brake on when you see an obstacle, first of all, you got to identify what the obstacle is. You got to see it. You need to have the data. You don't do surgery without an x-ray. I don't think you should do surgery on the tort system without an x-ray, and you can do it. In 18 months, the problem's going to be over without tort reform, without insurance reform, without any kind of reform, because the insurance industry's taking care of that. The problem is, what do you do in the 18 months? And that's the current problem. And in the tort reform, they admit, won't do it in the 18 months. What are the things you can do to solve the current problem? And then what about 10 years from now? What about the national problem of the cycle? I don't think putting limits on pain and suffering will have much effect, but I think we can prove whether or not it will by getting the data. A doctor in California took out the wrong kidney, and the award was $250,000. That's not fair either.
That's not true.
That's not correct.
That's incorrect.
I talked to the attorney.
Well, so you're wrong. He told you wrong.
Okay, well, he told me wrong.
Yeah.
Because it was a $5.3 million verdict, and it was reduced to $250,000.
No, it was not. It was reduced to $1.3 million.
The $250,000 for pain.
No, with $250,000. But the patient got $1.3 million.
Instead of $5.3.
Yeah, no, and on top of that, there was a settlement offer at $1.75 million. The plaintiff turned down.
All right. The point is, he got $250,000 for pain and suffering.
No, he got $1.3 million.
But that included his medicals and his.
He got $1.3 million. What are you talking about? $250,000.
What did he get for pain and suffering?
He got $1,300,000.
For pain and suffering.
For everything.
Okay, $250,000 for pain and suffering. The rest was for economic losses. And I don't think that's enough. I wouldn't take a wrong kidney. I wouldn't want to have my wrong kidney out.
No, we offered $1.75.
Hey, I'm not particularly interested in individual cases anyhow. What I'm more concerned about is a comprehensive solution to the overall insurance availability and price problem, and that's what I intend to work on. I'm sure we can substantiate at a later date if we feel it's necessary, and I'm sure that we won't. whether or not what the specifics were.
Mr. Chairman, you originally addressed that question to me too, and I won't take much time, but I think one thing that's been made clear is that no matter what you do this year, that probably isn't going to be enough, that this system is designed to be an evolutionary system. It has been evolving, and any changes to it it's going to take continuous scrutiny from this legislature and a lot of other ones. You're talking about really two problems here. One is availability, and the other one is price. 18 months, everything's going to be solved. Well, maybe it will be in the sense that customers will be accustomed to paying a lot more money than they have been. So they'll sit there and say, they'll be kind of resigned, and they'll say, well, okay, this is the way it is. Maybe the profits will be to the point, and investment income will be to the point, that those things will be moderated by those factors. Availability, though, for a lot of risks, will not improve without some changes. My company isn't going to write a defendant, at least not knowingly, that has a lot of exposure under the joint and several liability rule. We're not going to take the defendant that we can look at and say, well, no matter what this person does under product liability, whatever it is, you know, what they, maybe it's 2, 3, 4, 5%, because we know when we make that judgment and charge for the 2%, we may get hit for the 90% or the 100% of it. So the selection of risks, if the underwriters continue to prevail, and right now they're doing that, is going to be a lot more difficult for the risks that are out there. The collateral source rule, it seems to me, is a very good start. All you're saying is that this jury that we trust to do lots of complicated things can know what's going on, and I agree with you that and not all insurance companies will agree with this, by the way, that subrogation rights have to be taken into consideration there, too. You can't take it away twice from a plaintiff. So those are the kinds of things that will work, and I think some kind of regulation of the contingency fees. I frankly don't know whether the 40, 25, 10% gradation that's in the bill is the right thing or not. I don't know if there's such a thing as the right thing, but there is no regulation at all now. There isn't even disclosure required. And, I practiced law even in probate courts where probate lawyers, at least where I practiced, had to go and ask the judge. You documented your time, you showed what you did, and you got a fee based upon all that. This system ought to have some kind of regulation. And the Rule 82 for Alaska, that I've completely forgotten that because I haven't dealt with some Alaska claims for a number of years, but I remember, you know, Rule 82, something needs to be done about that.
Would you say, as a follow-up, would you say that it's fair to expect if we're going to limit contingency fees, and if we look at it on a percentage-wise basis, plaintiffs versus defense costs, defense are higher, is that...
Oh, well, you don't know. That's all a guess because you don't have any way of tracking what the plaintiff's fees are. Defense costs are, I can agree with you, are out of sight.
Okay, if you're saying we should limit contingency fees which affect the plaintiff's attorney, would you say it's fair to... at the same time, attempt to limit defense attorney's costs?
Well, it might be fair. I don't know exactly how you do it, though, because the defense lawyer is working on an hourly basis. The plaintiff, under our system, works under a contingency. I don't know how maybe you limit it so that they're equal and no more than... Yeah, I agree with it in principle. I haven't worked out the details how you do it.
The problem is that if we limit the contingency fees, say, and it drops plaintiff's attorney's percentage of the award down to, say, 20... while defense attorney's costs are at 40 or whatever they are, and I'm not sure, let's just say that they're double what the plaintiffs are, is that a fit? If we limit the plaintiff's attorney's fees.
Yeah, I hate to disagree with my colleagues. We've had some, you know, and I'm not talking about just the one I cited. Defense fees used to be about a nickel out of the premium dollar, and they're up in the 25 to 30% range right now, and they're going higher. Maybe what you're talking about when you talk about limiting fees, you're ultimately talking about a no-fault system.
How about
where you everything is no fault? You go to a New Zealand approach where there isn't pain and suffering, but there's also no litigation. I think it's going to be hard. I agree that it ought to be done. I think it's very difficult to do, and it interferes to some degree with an insurance company's, you might have to tinker with our obligation to defend. If we are limited to what we can pay a defense lawyer, our obligation to defend becomes of less value, perhaps, to that client. But we've got the obligation. Now, we have to have permission to change that. Something else. Some companies, ours included, we do the best we can to cut our defense fees, including maintaining a very substantial population in our company of lawyers who do nothing but that. They are employed by us, and all they do is defend cases, and it's a lot less expensive for us to do that than to hire outside counsel. But, I don't know if you can mandate that be done across the board.
I think that what Mr. Keneally is saying in principle is that, yes, that end of the legal expense ought to be diminished too, and I certainly agree with that. As I said a little earlier, there's been a liability industry, and its practitioners have seen to it that they get very, very fat indeed on the operation of that liability industry. And nobody's been watching them for years and years and years. We're right back to the same thing. I think you ought to watch all sides of it.
Thank you. I appreciate all of your candor, and I appreciate your coming to testify before us. And if there are no objections, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.